Welcome, everyone, to today's internet seminar. We're going to be talking about making Superfund site reuse a priority, why reuse is part of your job. My name is Michelle Mahoney, and I'm going to be moderating this session. I'm in EPA's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, who is sponsoring today's session. We're going to get started in a few moments, but while we're still waiting for some people to log on, I'm just going to cover a few housekeeping items. So when you registered for today's webinar, you were directed to the seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. And this front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We also have some bio sketches of the presenters and also their contact information if you want to contact anyone after the webinar is over. For those of you who have joined via the phone lines, we request that you put your phone on mute for the seminar. We are going to take time throughout the webinar for question and answer sessions, and I'm going to encourage everyone to use the question mark icon above your slides to submit questions via the internet, and we'll be reading those questions aloud when we get to those times. So for those of you who are on the phone, again, put us on mute. If you don't have a mute button on your phone, you can hit star 6 to place your phone on mute. That's star 6 on your keypad. And this will greatly reduce any background noises that can really disrupt the audio transmission, because we are recording today's session. And then also we'd ask that you don't put us on hold, because many organizations have hold music or other advertisements that can be very disruptive to the call. So keep us on mute and do not put us on hold. So by now, all of you should have clicked on the agenda for today's go-to session icon and be on slide number 1 of the presentation. And the main page here contains the slides, above which you're going to see the orange navigation icons. And as I mentioned, you can submit questions at any time during today's webinar using that orange question mark icon. And don't wait until we get to a point where we're going to ask you for your questions, because we'd like to have your questions ready in the queue when we get to that time so we can move along. And like I said, we encourage you to keep submitting these questions in advance as you think of them during our webinar today. If you do experience any technical difficulties with the audio stream, you can also use that question mark icon to alert us of your difficulties that you're encountering. But we ask that you include a telephone number where you can be reached, because we'll help you troubleshoot that problem. As the presenters move through the slides, they're going to announce the number of the slide to which they're on. And you can advance to the next slide using the right arrow located above the slide, or by clicking on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. So as I said, we were going to stop throughout the webinar today to take a few questions from our participants. And at the end of the presentation, we'll walk you through some links that we've assembled for you, and some documents, databases, and websites, and other things that are applicable to the topic today. And this information is going to stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can always access it after the presentation. We are recording today's session, and typically we place these seminars in an archive with a soundtrack. So in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. And then we also have we'll take you to a feedback form at the end of the presentation, and we ask that you consider filling out that form, because we do look at it as we're trying to improve the content of our, of our webinars and our delivery mechanisms. So with that, I think we're ready to start. I'm going to turn it over to Melissa Friedland, who's the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative Program Manager, who's going to kick off our session.
Thanks, Michelle. Good afternoon, everybody. Today our webinar is called Making Superfund Site Reuse a Priority, Why Reuse is Part of Your Job. And this training is designed to immerse you in Superfund reuse. We brought together presenters who are the most experienced in their field when it comes to redeveloping Superfund sites. And we're going to be discussing the tools and resources available when considering reuse. And we're going to provide case study examples for how these tools have been put to use. As Michelle said, there'll be plenty of opportunity for questions, and we hope that you come away from the training today with concrete ideas about how to support reuse at sites. Next slide.
I think it would work to watch it on this, or should I try to hook up the laptop?
I think one of our participants does not have their phone on mute, so if you could please take the time to Either hit the mute button on your key on your phone or hit star 6 so we don't disrupt the webinar. Thank you. And we're now on slide number 4.
Okay, thanks. So I'd like to start with a very brief introduction to reuse and EPA's Superfund redevelopment initiative. And I'll include an overview of why EPA cares about reuse and go into a little more detail about SRI, or Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, what it is, how we got started, and how we've evolved into what we are today. And then I'd like to spend the bulk of my presentation going into ways that SRI can help you in your work.
I'm not exactly sure how to do this from a hard... Has anyone ever done it from a...
Excuse me, we can hear you speaking, trying to figure out how to use your computer or something.
I'm very sorry, I had it on mute.
Okay, if you could please put us on mute, that would be great. Thank you.
And when I'm finished, I'll hand things over to Cecilia De Robertis from OSRI, who'll talk about our reuse directive. She'll be followed by Bill Denman, who's the Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator and an RPM in Region 4, who'll walk us through the Superfund cleanup pipeline and discuss how reuse considerations fit into each step of the pipeline. And then Bill will continue with a discussion of several reuse tools that are of particular use in Region 4. And then we'll hear from Fran Costanzi, who's a Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator and an RPM in Region 8, who'll talk about reuse assessments. And we'll finish with Tom Bloom, who's a Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator in Region 5, and who will conclude our session by covering another tool ready for reuse determination. So next slide. Okay, so reuse is not new. Communities have been reusing cleaned up sites for many years, and just in case this is the first you've heard of it, we're actually coming up on 15 years. So even though EPA's always been supportive of site reuse, it wasn't until 1999 that the agency launched the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. So our mission at SRI is to develop tools for site stakeholders to help promote reuse and work with regions to provide site-specific assistance. Next slide. We used to talk about our program in terms of the four P's, pilots, promotion, policy, and partnerships. And I'll just take a second to bring you up to date on where we are right now with those. When we started in 1999, we picked 10 Superfund redevelopment pilots. We don't do pilots anymore. We have an in-kind services contractor. We found that that works a lot more efficiently. We found that for promoting, one of the most effective tools we have is to share stories of what's been done. So in order to spread the word for our successes, we've developed communications tools and outreach programs, and you'll hear more about those as we go through the webinar. We have a lot of policy and guidance out there. We're going to be hearing from CCD Robertis on the reuse directive. We're also very involved in questions about long-term stewardship, institutional controls, liability issues, and we have a performance measure called the Site-Wide Ready for Anticipated Use. And finally, with our partnerships, we're always looking to find partners who can help us. We've partnered with the U.S. Soccer Foundation, with the Academy of Model Aeronautics, and we're always talking with other groups about how we might work with them to get reuse at a particular Superfund site. So next slide. I'd like to talk to you briefly about a number of new tools and resources that you'll hear more in more detail about in the following slides. Next slide. Okay. So as I said before, I think communication is key, and if a site is experiencing successful reuse, we want to make sure others who may be trying to implement reuse at their sites know about it. We found that one of the most effective tools we have is to share the stories of what's been done at other sites. So we've developed fact sheets, case studies, videos, brochures, and we're continuously updating our SRI website with success stories and current information. And if you haven't checked it out, I suggest you do that. We update our website on a regular basis with exciting new reuse success stories. And last year, we completed success stories in 4 different regions. We're always looking to develop new case studies. And if you visit our website, you can see stories for the HOD landfill, the Aerojet Corporation, MDI, the Milltown Reservoir, Midvale Slag, the former Spelman Engineering, and the South Point plant. Next slide. Our website is the hub for most of our tools. We use it to display successes in the various ways mentioned so far, but we also use it to provide additional information to anyone who might be interested in what we're doing. We've spent a lot of time developing videos, and we find that they're becoming increasingly useful. We post them on our website, we provide them to stakeholders, and we use them at trainings. We now have 11 videos on our website on topics ranging from alternative energy and recreational use at Superfund sites to site-specific case studies of reuse success. Next slide. So, through our regional seeds program, we provide startup funding for reuse planning at Superfund sites. And though our regional seed support is described in detail on our website, I'd like to take just a minute to explain this process. So displayed on the screen in front of you are a few of the maps and photographs that were part of the reuse plan for the Bandera Road Superfund site. And maps like these are instrumental in determining the reasonable future land use. Next slide. To initiate planning projects, SRI provides regional seed startup funds around the country. And through this work, we've seen that well-run community-based reuse planning has the potential to dramatically improve community relations and the public perception of the agency and what it's doing. It can also streamline the remedial process by clarifying the site's reasonably anticipated future land use and integrating that with a site's remedial strategy. And it can bring the agency and communities together around more cost-effective remedies that produce the greatest long-term value for local communities. Regional seeds are resources provided by SRI to communities at the request of EPA regional staff, and the seed concept provides an initial investment to bring the right stakeholders to the table. Once the reuse planning process gains momentum, communities can leverage the initial regional seed investment with local resources to continue the process of transforming Superfund sites into productive use. So we recognize that there is no one-size-fits-all category to make reuse happen, so we offer a number of different types of regional seeds to support reuse, and there are three general categories, which include situation assessments, where the purpose is to gather preliminary information to determine initial site reuse potential and scope further reuse planning assistance. We have reuse assessments, which determine a range of suitable options for future uses for the site to inform the cleanup process and local planning efforts. And we can use it for reuse plans, which outline specific locations and uses for the site based on additional stakeholder discussion and analysis. Next slide, please. Every year, SRI aims to provide trainings at appropriate national conferences, and these conferences allow us the opportunity to reach new stakeholders and learn new strategies that communities and cleanup teams are employing to reuse their sites. So this list is just some of the conferences we try to go to. Next slide. The Return to Use Initiative is currently one of SRI's primary efforts. It's focused on construction complete sites or sites that are partly cleaned up. And the initiative has one major purpose, to remove barriers to reuse that are not necessary for the protection of human health or the environment or the remedy at those sites where remedies are already in place. So as part of the initiative, we capture the lessons learned at the site and create demonstration projects so other cleaned up sites can benefit from the experiences. We also make an effort to do what we can to address the barriers and work with the regions to find out ways that headquarters could potentially help on a site-by-site basis. So just some examples, we'd provide regional seed resources, we'd identify and share examples that promote lessons learned, and we help regions draft ready for reuse determination. Next slide. Our site-wide ready for anticipated use measure was developed in 2006 to report the Superfund program's accomplishments in making land ready for reuse at NPL construction complete sites. And the introduction of this measure reflects the high priority that EPA places on land reuse as an integral part of the agency's cleanup mission for the Superfund program. In fiscal year 2012, we had a net total of 66 sites meet the measure. Next slide. In April 2010, we published the Land Use Directive, considering reasonably anticipated future land use and reducing barriers to reuse at EPA LEED Superfund remedial sites. The document's designed to further assess Superfund sites and explains guidance tools such as reuse assessments and reuse plans, even developing remedial action objectives. It's a very valuable tool. Cecilia is going to be going into a little more detail about how this guidance can help your work at the site in just a moment. Next slide. I hope I've given you a brief overview. If you have any questions or if there's anything I mentioned that you'd like more information about, don't hesitate to get in touch with me. But for today, I'm going to take this opportunity to hand the training over to Cecilia, who'll talk about our REUSE directive and why it's such an important resource for you and your resource work. So, Cecilia, I'm handing it over to you.
Great. Thank you so much, Melissa. All right, everybody. We should be on slide 17. If you got lost a little bit in the shuffle, just click on slide 17 in the banner on the left. So my name is Cecilia Darabertis, and I'm part of EPA's Office of Site Remediation Enforcement, which is the legal enforcement office. And today I'll be talking about that 2010 reuse guidance, which was mentioned on slide 15. So let's move to slide 18. So the purpose of this module is to really discuss why we have that directive done in 2010, go over the key points in that directive, and to emphasize the new messages in it. Next slide. So there actually was a land use directive that was written in 1995, and the directive emphasized the need to consider future land use while making remedy selection decisions under CERCLA at sites that are on the national priorities list. That 1995 directive notes that EPA should focus on early community involvement, especially a community's desired future uses on the property. And the hope is that incorporating these considerations should result in a more democratic decision-making process, which will lead to greater community support for remedies selected as a result of that process. Fran Costanzi will actually talk about this directive a little bit more during her presentation as well. So if you could now click onto slide number 20. So if there was a directive written in 1995, why did there need to be another reuse directive written in 2010? And that's really essentially because the first 1995 directive really talked about sites that were in remedy selection. Now most sites are past remedy selection. Regions started having questions about how to support reuse throughout the entire cleanup process, and regions had some questions about what to do if a reasonably anticipated future land use was changed after a record of decision. So on to slide 21. The 2010 directive is expanded to cover the entire cleanup process. It looks at different things that weren't in the first land use directive, such as what happens after a record of decision, updated IC language, IC being an institutional control, and factors that you need to consider when pursuing a change to a remedy. I think the graphic on the bottom of slide 21 pretty much sums it up. The 2010 reuse directive covers all of the cleanup pipeline. So slide 22. When you're changing the land use remedy in after a record of decision, there's two primary questions. Does the new land use impact protectiveness, and also who pays for it? And the 2010 directive actually does look at this. If you would turn over to slide 23, there's a graphic that I think adequately explains the thought process. So the first question is, you know, if a person or party wants to change the land use after record of decision is signed, the region has to evaluate whether the proposed change to determine whether the proposed change will adversely affect the protectiveness of the remedy, and if the remedy modifications would be necessary to allow the changed land use. EPA's role in any subsequent additional cleanup needs to be determined on a site-by-site basis. So first you look at the proposed change based on the sites. After that, you look at whether or not it's within the CERCLA scope of authority. If the change is within the scope of authority, the region has the discretion to use funds for that process. However, if it's not in the scope of authority, EPA must first get a commitment from the state, tribe, potentially responsible party, or the other responsible parties that want the changes. We're going to need to get a commitment to pay for the costs and to fund the costs of those changes. Throughout that process, when you're looking at the scope of authority, you're going to want to consult with the Assessment and Remediation Division. in EPA headquarters, and you're going to evaluate some factors to determine whether the remedy change is appropriate. I'm going to go over those factors in a few more slides. So if you go to slide 24, another thing to consider are institutional controls. For those of you who are not familiar with institutional controls, they are the administrative and legal controls that help minimize the potential for human exposure to contamination, and or they're controls that are put in place to protect the integrity of a remedy. Future land use is highly tied into institutional controls, and affected parties should be consulted when you're going to change a use, because it could heavily change your institutional controls, and you should look at what groups should be affected, what kind of stakeholders are involved, and especially local governments, because a lot of local governments actually are the stewards of institutional controls. So moving on to slide 25. As I mentioned earlier, there were some factors to consider. I'm going to go over them for the next few slides. I'm going to brush over them fairly quickly, but I've actually included the original language that's in the directive just so that you can always go back and look into it. So slide 26. Factor number one looks at whether the change is protective. Factor number two looks at whether the reasonably anticipated future land use is feasible. Factor number three looks at whether the changes will affect or conflict with the National Contingency Plan. Slide 27. Factor number four looks at how the changes may influence the local community, and that does include environmental justice communities as well. Factor number five evaluates data and the quality of data and evaluation and the level of evaluation involved in coming up with the reasonably anticipated future land use, and whether it conflicts with anything in the record of decision. Factor number six is about finances and cost. For example, will these changes ultimately lead to long-term savings? Moving on to slide 28. Factor number seven looks at whether any additional expenses at fund lead sites are prohibited enhancements or betterments. Factor number eight looks at potentially responsible parties sites and if they can cover the costs or where that money will be coming from. And factor number nine looks at whether the new use leads to a more or less stringent cleanup. So moving on to slide 29, which is my last substantive slide. There are actually a lot of myths about redevelopment and reuse, and there's no denying that we get feedback from time to time that reuse shouldn't be a priority. And I thought that this slide would be a good time for us to address some of those myths. The first myth is that redevelopment is not in the agency's mission, and that's not the case at all. Reuse has become so integrated in the agency's way of doing things that it's been in the last several strategic plans. Another myth is that EPA has no authority to address land use, and actually CERCLA gives EPA broad legal authority to undertake studies, investigations, and information gatherings to plan for and to direct Superfund cleanup actions. The National Contingency Preamble discusses the consideration of anticipated future land use and explains the role that considering future land use plays in the remedial process. There's also the myth that redevelopment activities use up dollars and that should be used for cleanup. And conducting studies to identify the reasonably anticipated future land use of land at Superfund sites is often an integral part of the cleanup. Considering future use is normally a normal part of the risk assessment, which contributes to the establishment of cleanup objectives, and it also ensures that remedies that are chosen will be protective for future users. Another myth is that reuse planning gives people false expectations. Re-planning, actually, when it's done correctly, should give realistic estimates of the time required to clean up a site or appropriate reuse options for after cleanup. So reuse planning provides information to communities so that they can make informed decisions about what a future land use might be, and it can improve relationships with communities and also incorporate communities as part of the cleanup process and decision-making process. Lastly, there's the myth that Superfund redevelopment means big box stores and making developers rich. And local communities seeking to identify an appropriate future land use for their Superfund sites often prefer amenities like parks, green space, athletics fields, instead of commercial development. Effective reuse planning can often prompt local communities to think more deeply about what is actually feasible given contamination, what is achievable in a cleanup, what the surrounding land uses are, and what other factors they really need. So many communities have set aside space for commercial and industrial development, but maybe also they can look at their long-term uses of land, and the planning process can help focus and redirect the community's ideals. So moving on to slide 30, this is my contact information should you have any questions. There's also a link to the Revitalization Handbook, which is a guide that discusses and breaks down liability considerations throughout the cleanup process, and I've included it because it can be a very useful resource to answer your future questions. And that is all that I have for today, so I'd like to hand things over to Bill Denman.
Thanks, Cecilia. I appreciate the introduction, and that was a really good summary, I believe, of the guidance, certainly the most recent guidance that dictates how we or what we're able to do in the Superfund process. Then I'm going to be talking more about how we've implemented it specifically in Region 4, but from the perspective of a remedial project manager. So as Cecilia said, my name is Bill Denman. I'm a remedial project manager in EPA Region 4, which is the Southeast region. We've been very successful in implementing redevelopment policies and guidance to help get our sites back into productive use after they've been cleaned up, and so I'm going to talk a little bit about that as it fits into the remedial pipeline. This presentation was adapted from one that I gave to other remedial project managers a couple years ago, so it will try to steer away from too many acronyms, too much jargon that may only be applicable to RPM. So for those of you on the phone that aren't very familiar with the Superfund process, I'm going to try to keep it such that I don't lose you with acronyms. So we're on slide 31, so if you will, go to the next slide. Fitting reuse into the cleanup pipeline. Again, that's what my segment of the webinar is about. I'm going to be talking about developing remedial action objectives, selecting our remedy. We're going to talk about a couple of case studies where we actually did this at a couple of sites. And then I'm going to end it up by discussing some of the tools that we frequently use here in Region 4 and how we use them and when they're applicable. So next slide, please, slide 33. So the first thing we do, and any of you familiar with the Superfund process probably already know this, but the first thing we do is we develop remedial action objectives when we investigate a site and are looking at cleanup. We want to know, for example, are we trying to restore the aquifer to beneficial use? Are we trying to minimize the potential for exposure to soil above levels that are not protective for people? Are we trying to limit the transmission of contamination from the surface into the groundwater table? Are we trying to protect a wetland or a water body? So, this is the first stage where we're generally looking at what our objectives are as we conduct our remedial action. Next slide, slide 34. So how would we consider reuse here? Well, as Cecilia and Melissa both said, we're required to determine the reasonably anticipated future land use, preferably as early as we can in the process. We call that RAFLU, which is what RAFLU is, reasonably anticipated future land use. The statement over on the left below the picture is from the land use directive, and it's where we get our authority for doing this. And how would we do that? Well, we can do it by talking with local land use planning authorities, city council, city managers, city planners, state officials. Of course, the property owner is a key person to talk to about future land use, because EPA doesn't have authority, certain authorities, except in those very few instances where we actually own land, which is very rare. So we'd want to know what the property owner's plans or expectations of using the property are, even if they're a liable party. And of course, the public. You know, we depending upon the situation of the site, the public may will definitely have input in our remedy as required by the NCP, but they also may be able to have input into the future land use. And so, again, you know, this all falls back to the 1995 Land Use Directive, which was a precursor to the Reuse Directive that Cecilia talked about. And if you remember the graphic that she showed at the bottom, the Land Use Directive kind of talked about that investigation through remedy selection part, whereas the Reuse Directive covered the entire Superfund pipeline. Next slide. So what can I do to understand what the reasonably anticipated land use is going to be? This is, you know, there's several ways of doing this. We have guidance on different ways you can go about this. I talked about a few in the previous slide. Just talking with the land use planners, looking to see if the local government, whether it's a city or county or whatever, has a future plan for the area where your site is, talking to the landowner. But the mechanism for which we do these, I'll be talking about in the next slide. So if you'll go to slide 36, the primary way to do that is to perform a reuse assessment. EPA has guidance for that, reuse assessment guidance, to gather information you can use about future land use that will inform not only the remedial action objectives, but also the baseline risk assessment and whatever our subsequent response actions are going to be. Fran's going to be talking more in depth about reuse assessments later in the webinar, but just keep in mind that a reuse assessment can be conducted at a single point during the remedial process, and so we can update the reasonably anticipated future land use if that changes. So those of you who have been involved with the Superfund process knows that these things take a really long time, and so we can perform an initial reuse assessment, but it's something we want to keep an eye on as things change, economies go up and down. Plans for property may change quite a bit. Next slide. So who are the stakeholders? We talked about the site owner. Obviously, they're the key stakeholder. They have the ultimate decision on what they do on property they own. Of course, it has to be consistent with, you know, local zoning requirements and permitting requirements and all that. But you also would have a developer. We've had a lot of developers who come in at various stages of the cleanup process, very interested in redeveloping a piece of property. And that all has to do with location. If it's in a location and if it's the right size and has the right amenities that they're looking for, it's something that a developer may be very interested in. And certainly they're a stakeholder in us determining what the future use is going to be. Potentially responsible parties, state and local governments, community members, as we said, if the community is involved and wants to have say so in the future use of the property, depending upon the owner and how the property is situated, they may have a significant role in determining the future use. Community advisory groups, and really any group with a vested interest in the site can participate in the reuse assessment process is certainly something group that we want to talk with. Next slide. So what is the stakeholders' role? They can help ensure that any uncertainties and potential issues about the reasonably anticipated future land use are identified and systematically addressed through the reuse assessment, which, you know, can help us produce a more successful remedy selection. And, you know, it's important to realize here, not only are we talking about what the future use is from determining how much to clean up, but it's also how to clean up. So, for example, instead of, and oftentimes the reuse assessment or good reuse planning can result in a lowered remedial cost, because if we know that certain areas are going to be beneath huge buildings or parking lots, or you know, stormwater ponds or whatever, then we can design our remedies such that if you know we clean up what people are going to be exposed to, and then we ensure that people aren't exposed to things that are beneath slabs or parking lots or whatever. Stakeholders can provide betterments and enhancements. We can't do that. EPA is prevented, of course, from you know, building community centers, building parking lots, building, you know, improving or enhancing the property. But stakeholders, developers, PRPs can do these things. And so if we're having a useful discussion with them about what the future use is, they may say, oh, that's where I want to put whatever. And so then we can use that information to help design our remedy. We don't like to rely on it too much, especially early in the process, because as we said before, things change, and so we don't want our remedy to be completely dependent on a plan, but it certainly certainly informs what we do. And I guess that's a key point that, you know, people, I hope that everyone understands about redevelopment, is redevelopment doesn't determine or dictate a remedy, it informs the remedy. And so it's one of the pieces of information that we look at when we're determining how to clean up a site and how much to clean up at a site. You know, in other words, what type of use is it going to be? Is it going to be commercial, industrial? Is it going to be residential, recreational, agricultural, ecological? You know, those things make a big difference in how we would clean it up. But it doesn't, just because an area, you know, if a county commission were to zone an area residential and everybody just wants it that way just to get the most stringent cleanup and then determine what to use it for later, you know, certainly not something. It would be difficult to get EPA money to do that if it's not something that makes sense. So it certainly informs the remedy, but it doesn't dictate what the remedy is going to be necessarily. One of the key roles that stakeholders play, in addition to helping us determine how to clean it up, is our long-term protectiveness and our long-term stewardship. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. But having someone on the property, having the property developed, not only increases its taxable value, which of course is beneficial to the local government. It could provide jobs, which a lot of sites have, you know, that we've helped get into redevelopment. But also, EPA or the PRP has a responsibility to ensure the long-term protectiveness of a remedy. So, for example, if we've capped some contamination or if we're containing groundwater plume, we have to ensure in the long term that that's protective. And oftentimes a stakeholder, having someone there every day on the property using it, can help us do that. Next slide. Another tool that we have are called reuse plans. And a reuse plan can provide information about the future use of the site that's more specific than what we could determine just by talking, you know, with these local government people. Or you know, land use planners, and it can provide information about end uses that have broader acceptance in the community. And so what we mean by those two things, or how a reuse plan is conducted, is we actually go out and develop like a land use committee. It's made up of local government people, land use planners, but also members of the community, maybe a representative from a community advisory group or a TAG would be on it to make sure that everybody has a say-so in what the property is going to be used for. And I think this is the part that oftentimes that myth that Cecilia talked about, where we have unrealistic expectations developed, is really, to me, proven untrue time and time again. If with a good facilitated meeting or group of meetings, you know, brainstorming about what a site can be used for, then going back and studying the feasibility of that and coming back and reporting back to this group of what the real likely potential future uses are, people as a group generally come to pretty good decisions or agreement on what future uses are likely. So a lot of times the initial list is you know, contains parts of the remedy that are unrealistic. But I think once people see, you know, economic data, they see, you know, there's so many grocery stores within a 3-mile radius or so many parks or whatever, then they realize that maybe this does make sense for that or maybe it doesn't. And I think reuse plans are very helpful in helping us determine that. So just to briefly compare the two, a reuse assessment would give us information like the future use is going to be commercial, industrial, the future use is going to be residential, the future use is going to be recreational, whereas a reuse plan would say, oh, well, this area is going to be green space and this area would be commercial. It would be more specific and provide a map like you see in the slide here that would be a lot more specific than a reuse assessment about where actual things would happen. And that's very useful, again, when we go to design and implement our remedy. We can take this information into account, for example, of where to consolidate excavated material underneath parking lots or whatever, and it can reduce remedial costs and result in something that's useful for the community. Next slide, slide number 40. Another thing that we do early in the process is investigate available local resources with respect to institutional controls. I think this is something that we've learned over the years is very important because I've looked at a lot of records of decision, done this job over 15 years now, and some of the rods early on that were written before we had experience with institutional controls would contain general statements such, for example, institutional controls will be used to restrict access, or restrict access to contaminated groundwater. Well, one of the things we have to realize, and this is very site-specific, is to determine what kind of local resources are available that would actually allow us to put some sort of restriction on the property. You know, for example, are all wells required to be permitted in your area? If they are, then you can work with that permitting authority to restrict well permits to be issued. That's one way of keeping people from being exposed to contaminated groundwater. You know, does the area have zoning? You know, how strict is that zoning? Does the state have a UECA standard, a Uniform Environmental Covenants Act requirement that can be used? Do they have restrictive covenant or institutional control procedures that the state uses? Because when we put institutional controls on properties, whether we're restricting it to commercial industrial use or whether we're restricting potential for drilling wells or being accessing groundwater, we're relying on state rules and state regulations to do this. And so they're different in every state, they're different in every city. And so one of the things that is very important, and this is an extra benefit that comes out of doing this kind of reuse assessment and this type of thought process, is determining, first of all, what kind of institutional controls do you think you'll need? Not overly restricting the property. It's something that I'm particularly very sensitive to, and I've seen so many times where with good intentions, instead of restricting just what needs to be restricted, we've overly restricted properties. And I think that's a mistake, because it prevents things from happening where there's no reason that they shouldn't happen. So this is just a couple of examples about how we would investigate what type of institutional controls are available and how we might use them and how it might affect our remedy and the future use. Next slide.
Bill, this is Melissa. I just want to give you a time check. You're about halfway.
Okay, let's see.
Okay.
I'm looking at my stack of paper here, I'm not halfway through my slides, so thank
okay.
you.
Okay.
Speed things up a little bit.
Okay.
The second stage, you know, after we've done our investigation and feasibility study, we have to select a remedy. And so this is where, if you can go to the next slide, number 42, this is where decisions really matter, because, you know, this is our final remedy decision. This is going to outlay how we're going to clean up the site, what kind of restrictions are going to be put on the property, and it's important that we make good decisions here, because it's going to dictate how we proceed in the future. I think I've talked about these other things, so we'll move forward to slide number 43, which gets into the implementation of the remedy. So if you can go to 44, after we've selected a remedy, as most of you know, I'm sure if you're familiar with the Superfund process, we then design and implement that remedy. That's called the remedial design, remedial action phase. How we would consider reuse during these phases, during the design, that's when the details are really written out. Again, like I said before, we probably don't want to be too specific in the ROD about, you know, here's going to be the parking lot or here's going to be the stormwater pond or whatever. But once we've determined the remedy, for example, you're going to excavate and dispose of some soil off-site, some soil will remain on-site, you know, something like that, then in the design we would work out the details on how that would actually be implemented. And so that's where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, and you would work out those details. And then, of course, in implementation, there's a lot of really just communication and coordination. For example, we can't provide betterments or enhancements, but PRPs, local governments can. So, for example, if when we've excavated all the dirt, the local government wanted to put in, you know, some kind of pipe through the site or enhanced stormwater system or something like that, they could go in and do that while that would be needed for the development. They could go in and do that while we had the dirt all dug up, instead of having us put it all back and put a nice, you know, seeded grassy top on it and then come in and dig it up again. So it's really just thinking about how the site's going to be used and coordinating with the people who are going to be redeveloping it. Next slide. So we got a couple of case studies here on how we did this. The first one I'm going to talk about is the Wolf of Chemical Works site in Fort Valley, Georgia, or as the mayor likes to say, Fort Valley, USA. They just happen to be located in Georgia. It's very interesting, small town, kind of in central Georgia. About 31 acres. It was a pesticide production facility. I think we wound up with four or maybe five operable units, but OU3 focused on primarily the soil and the on-site buildings. Next slide. The remedy was to excavate the material, consolidated in a four-acre capped area. The ROD was signed in the late 90s. We amended it. The remedial action is pretty much completed now. So we've pretty much finished with the site. Next slide, 47. So how did we work reuse into this remedial process? Well, we had a very active community at the Wolfhook site. They even marched on the EPA office way back when. They were not happy with what we were doing and how we were doing it, and so we came in and we listened to what they said. We implemented some of the things the community wanted. We developed a community advisory group. We worked with them in the implementation of the remedy. We had meetings once a month for several years. The remedial project manager and the community involvement coordinator would go down to Fort Valley and meet with the mayor and the town people once a month, I think for 8 years. And developed a really good, strong relationship, and during that time started talking about the potential for future use at the site. And at this site, we did one of our earlier reuse planning activities, and we, of course, involved the mayor. We involved representatives from this community advisory group. Of course, EPA was involved and other folks, so that we could develop some realistic expectations, and we actually determined how we were going to clean the site up, because the town came to us and they said, there's two areas that we really want to redevelop early. We have this property that's across the street from the site that's contaminated. We'd like it if you could go ahead and clean that up, because we want to build a new library there. We had this librarian who was just, very dedicated to having the new library built and felt very strongly about it, as well as the mayor and the rest of the community. And so we worked with them to help, address that area first so that they could get their new library built. They also had an antebellum home there that needed renovation that was kind of, and the site is right in downtown Fort Valley, so it definitely impacts, the way the town looks and the way, it's what people see when they drive into the town. And he had this beautiful antebellum home there, and so we cleaned up around it, and it allowed them to renovate that and develop it into a city building where they house their, I think their tourist bureau and some of their other economic development people and stuff like that. So, it was an example of how we worked with the town of Fort Valley to get those areas cleaned up so they could do redevelopment. And then, if you'll move to the next slide, slide 48, you'll see a photo there of one of our meetings and how we worked with those folks. Through the reuse planning process for about 9 months to develop a reuse plan, which included, not only what we're going to do about these two things, but now what are we going to do about the actual site property. And now that it's cleaned up, we're working with the town and helping them get some of the uses that were thought about in the reuse plan implemented, which, of course, this happened, right about the time the economy had a downturn, and so there hasn't been very much, but but you know, working with the mayor to make things happen there. Next slide, number 49. I think I covered a lot of this. The town is interested in taking over the site, either acquiring it through back taxes or whatever, and we're working with them on that so that they can you know, help have more of a say so on what the future use is. There's a really good video, if anybody's more interested in this story, on the redevelopment website, that if you go to the headquarters Superfund redevelopment website and look under their videos, you'll see that. And it's called Life After Superfund. We completed the construction of the remedy in 2010. We've been wrapping all that up again. They have their new library, office space, their welcome center, and we're working with them on the other parts of the site. Next slide, so you can go to slide 51. I'll talk about a site that we have. You'll go to slide 52. Again, I think I've talked a lot about how reuse plays into long-term stewardship. Certainly, not only the implementation of institutional controls, but the maintenance of institutional controls. Just having people on the site is very useful for us. You know, because a lot of our sites are, you know, we don't see them that often, and so having somebody on the site that sees it every day and can help, you know, identify any problems early on is very useful. Slide 53. One thing I haven't talked about is our 5-year reviews, and so EPA, you know, every 5 years is required to conduct a review of the remedy to determine if it's still protected, if we leave contamination in place, or if the cleanup is not finished yet. And so the 5-year review process helps us identify if there are any additional institutional control or any changes in land use that might affect the protectiveness of the remedy. But it also, we take another look at what restrictions have been placed on the property and determine from that whether or not there need to be any changes or any maybe some work by EPA, whether it's making an institutional control less strict if it was one of those older ones that is too strict, or, you know, changing it somehow to help get the site put back into productive use. It's one of the things we can do there. Next slide, number 54. So here I'm going to talk about how the site plays into the site after the construction of the remedy is complete, when it's in long-term O&M, and I have an example. If you'll go to slide 55, which is the Pepper Steel and Alloy site in Medley, Florida, which is outside of Miami. It's a 25-acre site. There were a lot of businesses on the site. There was soil contamination. If you'll go to the next slide, 56. There were several private property owners, and Florida Power and Light were the PRPs that cleaned up the material. They solidified it. They completed the remedial action in 1989 and then left. And if you go to the next slide, 57, from 1989 to 2002, it was vacant. We had a nice solidified cap that was draining all the water into a nice drain field, and it didn't take very long for that drain field to get just overgrown with vegetation, as well as the cap. And so beginning in 2002, when we did one of our 5-year reviews, we noticed that this site really had fallen into disrepair. We went in and had to, EPA had to conduct some work because of the way the agreements were. We had to do some of the work to get it back, to make sure the remedy was going to continue to be protective. And then we partnered with different people who were interested in redeveloping the site. And the site actually has, I think, 3 or 4 parcels. And if you'll go to the next slide, 58, one of the users of the property makes the big concrete pieces that are in stormwater control systems. And so he's in the stormwater control business and helped us address some of the stormwater issues on the site. We got rid of some of the debris that had been dumped on the site because the fence had been cut down. People were just dumping on the site. We're implementing the appropriate institutional controls on these different parcels to make sure that it remains protected. But in the meantime, you know, it's important to understand that there are people coming in and using this. We had somebody that renovates the sea land containers that you see on ships and on trucks when they get damaged. He purchases them, stores them on one of these parcels. It's a very, very industrial part of Miami. and then takes them to his facility, restores them, and then sells them as used. So different uses like that were certainly very compatible with the site condition, and it had somebody interested in making sure the site was taken care of. Go to slide 59. Now I'm going to talk about a few tools that we use in Region 4 and how do we get this done. So you'll go to slide 60. Probably the most effective tools that we use in Region 4 are two things: our prospective purchaser inquiry call, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, followed up by a status letter, which basically memorializes what we talk about on that call. Slide 61. The purpose of the prospective purchaser inquiry call is when you have someone that's interested in purchasing a site, this is a service that we offer. It's free. They don't have to pay for it. People can call in. If they want to purchase the property, we'll take the time to talk to them. We provide them fast, accurate, and comprehensive information, and our goal is to give them that information so they can make a timely business decision on whether or not they want to purchase the site. We're not judging our success based on whether or not the site is redeveloped, because sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't, but we feel it's our job to make sure people have the information they need to make that decision. It provides a one-stop place for them to get that information, and we can talk about all the revitalization reuse tools that we have and determine which is most appropriate to use in their situation. Next slide. So when someone's interested, they call us. They may call the project manager, the community involvement coordinator, the attorney, me as the redevelopment coordinator, and say, I'm interested in purchasing this site. And so if you'll go to the next slide, 63, we organize the prospective purchaser inquiry reuse team, which is always consists of the RPM or the OSC and the site attorney. But we also may have risk assessors, sometimes as SRI coordinator participate, community involvement coordinators, our enforcement project managers, which are our cost recovery people, because we talk about liens and cost recovery issues, and we need to get those addressed early on. Sometimes state people participate. It really depends on the state and the site and whether or not they want to participate or not. So next slide, 64. Depending upon how familiar everybody is with the site, we usually almost always have a meeting before the call just to talk about these issues before the call and determine what our strategy is. What can we do? What can't we do? What are some of the roadblocks that we already see that we want to make sure that a prospective purchaser knows about before they purchase? Slide 65. So then, once we have it set up, it's usually a conference call. It's sometimes a meeting with the prospective purchaser. And from the prospective purchaser side, they can invite whoever they want. It could be PRPs, local governments, investors, bankers, attorneys, environmental professionals, whatever. And again, we might have some of those folks at the bottom participate as well. Next slide. We noticed when we first started doing this, there are four real issues that everybody had. Number one is, what's the status of the site? What are you going to do at the site? What kind of restrictions are going to be at the site? And this is the RPM's part of this call. We tell them what we think we're going to do, even if we don't know for sure. And we'll tell them, look, we don't know. We don't have a rod yet, but we'll probably have to excavate some soil over in that, northwest area, or we'll probably have to restrict the use of groundwater, or we only plan to clean it up to commercial industrial standards. Those kind of conversations. Then number two, we turn it over to them, and we say, what are you going to do with the property? And that gives them an opportunity to talk about their use, and we say, look, we can't guarantee your use is going to be compatible with our cleanup. That's your responsibility to ensure it is, but if there's anything obvious, we'll point it out to you. The third issue we talk about are liability issues, and that's where our redevelopment or our site attorney talks about the bona fide prospective purchaser provisions and the liability provisions that are available to prospective purchasers. And then the last issue are liens. We talk about, is there a Superfund lien on the property? Is there a windfall lien on the property? Or do we anticipate perfecting a windfall lien? Next slide. It's important, we've always put this in because it's important to realize that EPA will negotiate liens. So if we have a lot of times we'll put a lien on the property that says, it's for all of EPA's unrecovered costs. And that may well exceed the value of the property, and we realize that we would never get more than the value of the property. So we're certainly open to negotiating those liens. Slide 68. This is just a slide that talks about what liability provisions are available. The BFPP provision and windfall lien are the two authorities that were created in the Brownfield Amendments. The BFPP is a liability protection. Windfall lien is a lien authority that was given EPA. All right, let's see. I accidentally went to the end of the presentation here in my haste. I'm almost finished. Let's see, I think I was on slide 70.
Bill, you were on 69.
69, okay. Sorry about that. I hit the button just to the right of the other one, took me to the end of the presentation. Okay, on slide 69, these are the eight provisions that you have to meet to be a BFPP, which we'll skip over. You can read about those in various number of fact sheets. So slide 70, we offer the appropriate tools. We discuss with people, you know, which ones are the best to use based on their situation. Slide 71, as I said, we then offer a status letter, sometimes called a comfort letter, to memorialize what we talk about on that call. And that letter will also contain reasonable steps, which is one of the eight criteria in the to be a BFPP, and so we identify what those are in the status letter, which is very useful to prospective purchasers. They kind of know what they're, you know, going to have to do. Slide 72. This is my contact information. Feel free to call or email me if you have any questions, or, of course, we can ask them on the call here. There are links to the headquarters and Region 4 Superfund redevelopment websites. There's tons of information on those two websites. I encourage you to go and surf around on them. There's a lot of fact sheets, success stories, videos, some really, really interesting stuff. So it's a good way to find out more information. And with that, I believe our next presenter is Fran. So I'm going to turn it over to Fran Costanzi in Region 8.
Thanks, Bill. Hi, everyone. As Bill said, my name is Fran Costanzi, and I'm an RPM and the Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator in Region 8, which is located in Denver, Colorado. I'm going to refocus us back on reuse assessments. So you should be on slide 73, and please go to slide 74. My part of the presentation is going to talk about key background documents and introduce the reuse assessment basics, and then I have a case study, as Bill did, on the Midvale Flag site, which was a site I worked here in Region 8. It's actually located in the state of Utah. So, 75. As everyone before me has said, Congress really intended reuse to be a part of our program, and it's built in through our documents, and we've gotten more tools and more support over time. But we're going to talk a little bit about some of the history, starting with the National Contingency Plan. The NCP preamble specifically discusses land use assumptions regarding baseline risk assessments. And the baseline risk assessment, as we know, provides the basis for taking a remedial action at a Superfund site and supports the development of remedial action objectives, or RAOs. Land use assumptions affect the exposure pathways that are evaluated in the baseline risk assessment. Back in 1988, the Remedial Investigation Feasibility Study Guidance, which is still in effect, talked about and supported the position that considering reasonably anticipated future land use, or RAFLUs, uses is a legitimate and integral part of the RFS process. You can find it in several places in the guidance, including page 2-5, where it talks about demographic and land use information to help identify potential human receptors, and also in 3-10, which talks about information on expected land use as well as current land use. You've also heard about on this call the 1995 Land Use Directive, which was written in response to criticism that EPA was selecting unrestricted use more often than needed, meaning that we were cleaning up or deciding to clean up to residential uses when people argued it may not be necessary, and not reasonable for a site. So according to that directive in 1995, the agency should determine a site's reasonably anticipated future land use before issuing the remedy decision. Going on to slide 76, other background documents are the ROD guidance, which its most recent version came out in 1999. And the ROD guidance refers to and states that the ROD, the Record of Decision, should discuss the reasonably anticipated future land use and potential beneficial use of groundwater for that site or that operable unit. The role that the community and other site stakeholders play should also be explained in the Record of Decision. In 2001, we came out with a reuse assessment guidance, which was written to affirm the land use directive and to extend it to also include non-time critical removal actions and also to assist as a tool in developing reuse assessments. This is actually where we started using the term reuse assessment. Before that, it was something you needed to do during your remedial investigation process, but it didn't have its own term. And then in 2002, there was the memo that we've discussed on this call about reuse considerations during CERCLA response actions. And then finally, in 2010, another directive considering reasonably anticipated future land use and reducing barriers to reuse at EPA-led Superfund remedial sites. Slide 77. So the reuse assessment guidance, which I encourage you to read, it's very short, only about 7 pages long, reaffirmed the land use directive and highlighted its importance in achieving the goals of the Superfund redevelopment initiative. It extended the applicability of the land use directive to non-time critical removal actions where appropriate and introduced the reuse assessment, as I said. 78, it defines, the reuse assessment guidance defines reuse assessment as part of the remedial process that involves collecting and evaluating information to develop assumptions about reasonably anticipated future land uses at Superfund sites. The goals of a reuse assessment on slide 79 is to develop assumptions regarding reasonably anticipated future land uses, or RAFLUs. If you say that enough, you know why we ended up coming up with an acronym for it. And then it also, the goals of the reuse assessment is to document the process and basis for determining reasonably anticipated future land uses. Moving on to slide 80, a reuse assessment should reflect what we know about the existing uses at a site, EPA's current level of understanding and certainty regarding future site uses, and data elements needing clarification to better anticipate the reasonably anticipated future land use. If you pull up the reuse assessment guidance, it actually has an outline for what would go in a guidance and lists a bunch of relevant questions to help you answer these three things about what we know about current uses, our understanding, and different data elements. And so I encourage you to go and read that. Who actually conducts reuse assessments? Typically, either EPA or the state, whomever has the lead for the remedial investigation, would typically conduct it on a fund lead site, or on an enforcement lead site, the responsible party could do the reuse assessment. However, EPA or the state is responsible for ensuring that reasonable assumptions can be made. Are being made regarding reasonably anticipated future land uses, because this then feeds into the risk assessment, the remedial action objectives, and also ultimately the remedy. So, for example, it could be possible that a PRP not wanting to clean up a site to a residential level, even though that is a likely future use, might draft your reuse assessment in such a way that that doesn't appear to be the reasonably anticipated future land use, even though in reality, that is what is likely to happen. So it's important that EPA and the state actually review and agree with the reuse assessment and ensure that reasonable assumptions are indeed being made. On to slide 82. Bill touched on this, but there's a difference between a reuse assessment and reuse planning, though there is overlap. A reuse assessment is a part of the remedial process. It's a part of work that we are supposed to be doing during the remedial investigation. EPA manages this process, EPA working with the state. Typically, there's a focus that it's prerequisite of decision, though Bill gave some examples of where you would relook at this post-ROD. It identifies broad potential categories of use at a site. So is it likely to be residential? Is it likely to be commercial? Are there ecological uses? And also, let's not forget, are there mixed uses? Because it's certainly possible that you could have an office park or a residential development and also have a park or nature trails as a part of it. So it's important that we think through what are the reasonably anticipated uses or use at the site. And in the end, we need to document this so it's clear in our record of decision how we came up with our best analysis at the time about what the reasonably anticipated future land uses should be. As I mentioned, Bill talked somewhat about reuse planning. It's voluntary, so it's not formally a part of the remedial action process, so it can inform it. It's community-based. It can have a pre-ROD focus. It can also happen after the ROD. And it identifies more specific land uses with a footprint and usually maps. The end result is usually a site reuse plan that can be used for developing a site. Moving on to slide 83, the minimum requirement set by the reuse assessment guidance is that you should, in this process, in your remedial investigation, in the reuse assessment, identify your broad categories of use, residential, commercial, ecological, recreational, or, as I mentioned, mixed use. And though I hope it's clear that we don't consider any of these uses better than another. It's what makes sense for that site based on the information available. They're all valid uses for a site. And then this would support the remedy selection ultimately in the record of decision. So you have this information. It helps inform your baseline risk assessment, your exposure scenarios. That helps you develop your remedial action objectives. And then you use that to actually develop your cleanup alternatives and ultimately what gets selected in the record of decision. So now we're going to talk about a site that I worked on in Utah, the Midvale Flag case study, starting on slide 84. Moving to slide 85, a little bit about the site. It's that it's a fairly large site, a former smelter. It was 446 acres near Salt Lake City, Utah. There were two operable units at the site, and actually, by the time I took over the site, operable unit one had been completed, and we were working on the remedial investigation for operable unit two. What we ended up doing as a part of the reuse assessment impacted the completed operable unit one. And we considered the things that Bill and Cecilia have talked about when we had to go back and sort of revisit what was done for the other operable unit. A little bit of the history. There were five smelters on or around the site over a period of years from 1871 to 1958. There was an adjacent mill on the contiguous Superfund site called Sharon Steel. Heavy metal contamination in the soil and groundwater, and the Midvale Flag site was listed on the National Prairies List in 1991. And that's a picture of what it looked like during operation. great location currently, so the potential for reuse was there. It's right near downtown Salt Lake. It's right near two different interstates. There were rail lines going through the site. The Jordan River ran along the western border of the site, so there were a lot of opportunities if only we could figure out how to use them. On slide 88, this site was one of our initial pilots that Melissa talked about in the beginning of the presentation, so they got a grant to help work with us to figure out how they might redevelop the site, along with us figuring out how the site might get cleaned up. Ultimately, it became a return-to-use demonstration project. We did a ready-for-use determination that Tom will be talking about next, and there's currently reuse at the site. But if you go to slide 89, you kind of look like you have a picture of what the site looked like when we were doing our remedial investigation. There were some buildings left, there was a lot of debris, a lot of contamination, huge slag piles. But what we had to work with was that both the Sharon Steel and the adjacent, both the Midwest Slag site and the adjacent Sharon Steel site were almost the only land available for expansion in this area of the Salt Lake Valley. And the Sharon Steel site had been cleaned up, but yet they hadn't really considered, as it says on slide 90, they hadn't really considered reuse as they were doing that cleanup. It was a cap site with steep slopes and very hard to redevelop because of how the cap was designed and the restrictions. So what we heard early on at Midville Slag was they didn't want another Sharon Steel. They didn't want that kind of situation. The city and the community really felt that they needed a way to be able to utilize the land on the Midvale Slag site and redevelop that area. So we, EPA and the state of Utah, really worked hard at trying to listen and be inclusive and tried to meet these needs in addition to having a protective cleanup. On slide 91, we talked about some of the things we should do, which ended up mirroring the reuse assessment guidance, which was in the process of being developed at the time, but it's, in many cases, just common sense. We work closely with the local government. There was also a citizens group, Citizens for a Safe Future for Midvale, that we gave a technical assistance grant to. Luckily, the property owner, it was mostly owned by one individual, had a legal counsel that understood Superfund, and that really helped in us coming to a common understanding. The city staff, including city council, took lessons on what was Superfund and how they could implement and involve themselves. The city stepped up to the plate and participated in every step of the way in reviewing documents and understanding what was going on. And in addition, they invited us to understand and participate in their development of their land use planning documents because they were redoing their city master plan at the same time. And then they work with us to get institutional controls that's actually going to help us with protectiveness of the remedy while also help them redevelop the site. So slide 92, we gave them, as I mentioned, a Superfund redevelopment pilot grant to help them develop the site. There was a stakeholder group that we met with frequently, very frequently, made of government officials and community members and also property owners. The city, through the grant, was able to hire a reuse plan for a firm to develop a reuse plan for the site, listening to all the stakeholders, which the city ultimately formally adopted. And then the city developed an overlay zone. They call it the Bingham Junction Zone, which actually helped lay out the institutional controls. So we had confidence that not only once the cleanup was done, that it would be protective, but it would be protective over time as the site got redeveloped. And that overlay zone allowed for a mix of uses, because remember, we were talking about hundreds of acres here. So residential, recreational, commercial, office space, light industrial, and transit are all present on the site. in slide 93, we did a bunch of things along the way because of the history with Sharon Steele and the rougher earlier history of the site. We had a lot to do to actually build trust and develop understanding. So we actually wrote language in the Record of Decision, which you can see here, to talk about how we really did support and envision that the site could be safely redeveloped. And so this language is actually from the Record of Decision. As I mentioned, the city then adopted the Bingham Junction plan and passed an ordinance and developed an overlay district, which serves as a guide for redevelopment and actually is where most of the institutional controls are located and how they are implemented today. One other thing that we were lucky enough to have at this site, if you go to slide 95, was some of the prior responsible parties at the site had settled out and the money got put in a special account. So we were able to use these monies to fund a position at the local government for Midvale City. And that person was the institutional control coordinator. So he was able to actually be present when developers came forward to help explain the cleanup, explain what controls were needed, and actually review the development plans. So EPA and the state did not need to be involved every single step of the way, but we could rely on our counterpart in the local government to help make sure that on the ground the institutional controls were being implemented as we all intended. If you don't have a special account at your site, the only way that you could do this is either the responsible party or the state was willing to pay for such a position because this is considered O&M and operation and maintenance, and you can't use Superfund cleanup dollars for this. But if you're able to use it, it's a great tool. And then slide 96 is some of the pictures of what's happening today. There's light rail, there's office buildings, there's a supermarket, and there's residential housing on the site today. So in summary, a reuse assessment should reflect what we know about the current uses of the site, our current understanding and certainty regarding future site uses, and data elements that are needed to clarify, needing clarification to better understand and anticipate the reasonably anticipated future land use. And then on slide 98, there's my contact information. You can find more information about this and also the Midvale Flag site on the headquarters website, which is there, and also on the Region 8 website, which you can get to from the headquarters website. And now I'd like to turn it over to Tom.
Thanks, Fran. This is Michelle. Just real quick before you get started, Tom, I just want to remind our participants that they can submit questions at any time during the presentation using the question mark icon above the slides. And at this point, it looks like we're going to wait till after you're finished, Tom, to have our discussion period with anything that participants want to talk about. So, again, just use the question mark icon and submit something online to us, and we'll read the questions aloud after Tom's finished his presentation. So go ahead, Tom.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah. Yep, you sound great.
Okay, slide 99 is our title slide for a ready for reuse determination talk. Go to slide 100, please. Yeah, here's an overview slide. I'm just going to talk about the applicability of an RFR, some of the steps to prepare a ready for reuse determination document, some of the roles that are and responsibilities of different players in the RFR process, and talk about briefly about some sites where our ready for reuse documents were successfully facilitated reuse. Slide 101. Okay, what's an RFR? Well, it's a technical determination document. It kind of came out as a concern or a tool for sites that had stigma concerns. It's not a tool for liability concerns. It's a tool for stigma concerns. We had some sites where people were afraid to use the sites because they knew what had happened out there in the past. And even though we had made them protective, they were still afraid to use the sites. So we wanted to come up with some kind of a document that would write in plain language and explain to the people who had these fears what happened out at the site, what had been done off the site, and kind of saying that the site is okay for a certain type of a reuse, a general type of reuse, that we've cleaned it for an industrial reuse or a commercial reuse or an industrial slash commercial reuse. And also, it also helped to, the ready for reuse document helped communicate where the site's at and some of the things that had happened at the site in like I said, a more plain language form than the technical documents. Slide 102, please. Okay, here's a picture of one. It looks like a certification, but it's not, and it's not a certificate. The cover, this is a cover of one where we've talked about, a lot of times it will say the site is ready for commercial or industrial use, and it's dated and it's signed. And what is important to realize about this, that this condition can be reversed if we find something new that makes it so that we don't believe that it's ready for commercial use anymore. Well, like, let's say if we found a whole bunch of drums out there after the fact, we would want to come back and say that this determination is not accurate anymore until we fix the problem, and then we would redetermine that it would be available. Next slide is 103. Okay, so once I said is why do we do it? It's because to deal with the stigma out of the site and to help facilitate reuse. Not only stigma from being protective, but also stigma from lenders. Banks are kind of afraid to lend money to people that want to develop on Superfund sites. So in the case of at South Point, it helped the Lawrence County Development Corporation to get funding to develop on the site, but it also helped them to get tenants into the site because the ready for reuse document said the EPA says the site is okay for commercial or industrial use. Once again, I said it's written in plain language. It talks about general uses like industrial, commercial, recreational, or residential, and it's kind of there to help with the real estate market and with also the community and the stigma concerns. Slide 104, please. Okay, why do we want to issue one? Well, a lot of times what happens is, you know, these sites are just chained up after we're done with them. They've got skull and crossbone signs on them. The property values around them have gone down the tubes. And by just putting a little pocket park in, by just taking those signs off that say that it's skull and crossbones out there, the property values around help start to come up. The people start to feel a little bit better about the area. They start to take a look at the site. So it really helps to, also it helps to improve the relationships between the different local parties that are out there that have been involved in the Superfund process along the way. Slide 105, please. Now, here we also, like I said, by having people on the site, it helps to provide long-term stewardship, and that's what we talked about a little bit earlier when Bill was talking. At the HOD landfill example, we had people that were going on the site with their all-terrain vehicles and tearing up the cap. We don't have that now because there's several athletic fields out there, and the parks director and the people using the park, their eyes and ears are on there, and they call in immediately when they see something going on out there. They take ownership of the property. They're very excited about keeping the athletic fields up to speed and cleaned up and policing them and protecting them. At the Calumet Container site, we had a site that's right on the border of Illinois and Indiana, and people had to pay more to get rid of their white goods in Illinois than they did in Indiana. So what did they do? They drove across the border and they dropped their white goods off, fly dumping them right on the Calumet Container site. Once we issued a ready for reuse document out there and redeveloped that site, people started looking at that site and reporting the people. We no longer had fly dumping and some of the stuff that was going on there because the eyes and ears of the community were on the site. Slide 106. So I'm talking very quickly, but basically, you know, it helps. This once again is written in a plain language. It states what in the document in plain language what you can do, what you can't do off the site, who's responsible for doing what. Like, for example, it might say no digging below 3 feet. That might have been something that came out a long time ago, but everybody forgot. But by issuing this ready for reuse document and saying if you're going to use the site to play, you know, sports on or you're going to do something, you have to call somebody up if you're going to go below 3 feet with them. So, and like I said, it helps to reinforce and restrict institutional control and land restrictions. Slide 107, please. It's not a legal document, so it doesn't help with liability concerns. We have prospective purchaser agreements. We have bona fide purchaser amendments. We have other ways to work to limit the liability concerns. Once again, it's not a certificate. The site has to meet the cleanup protectiveness, and it doesn't necessarily change any of the rights or obligations. It says in the small print of the ready for reuse document that the EPA or the state still has the right to come in and monitor groundwater wells, still has the right to, you know, do what they need to do there to do their environmental regulatory activities. Slide 108, please. Okay. So, but when can we use this? When can we apply a ready for reuse document? We can kind of use them in all different types of sites that we have. We can put them at NPL sites. We can use them on non-time critical removal sites. I've even used them on a few closed out time critical removal sites where a municipality wanted to take over the site and use it for a juvenile detention center. And they had a little bit of problem with working with the community and the county officials. So the ready for reuse document really helped out at that one. That was the Ingram Richardson Superfund site. We can also put it on sites with that are restricted and unrestricted if they have institutional controls or no institutional controls. And there's no requirement to issue a ready for reuse document. I mean, people can come to us and say they'd like one, but if there's not a real concern for lives, for stigma out there, or if there's not a real reason to do it, we probably would say if it doesn't add value, we wouldn't go through the process of trying to put one together. Slide 109, please. Okay, you can when can the site receive them? Most of the time, most of the time we're doing these ready for reuse documents when the site has already been cleaned up. We do have a couple of instances before the record of decision was selected where we completed the investigation. We determined that a parcel of the property had not been impacted. We completed our investigation report was our document that showed that a portion of the site to be kind of like whopped off and said this part of the site is ready for commercial use. But for the most part, we go through the whole cleanup process, and then afterwards we would issue a ready for reuse documentation. Definitely have to have institutional controls in place because that's part of our protectiveness of the remedy. Slide 110. Okay, now we're going to ask, you know, what happens with the rules on institutional controls? Well, certainly the rules of the institutional controls do not change. The institutional controls in place don't change with whatever we put in the record of with whatever we put in the ready for reuse document. In fact, we have to be careful when we put language in there that we don't confuse anybody or say anything different than what would be in the record of decision that talks about the institutional controls in place. Now, can we ever issue one when there isn't an institutional control in place? We can in certain circumstances, like I said, if we have a record of a site where we know that there's a portion that hasn't been impacted, where we can kind of like lop off a part and say that, you know, we don't have to have a legal restriction being protective out there. And I think it's, you know, the first time that each region issues a ready for reuse document, we definitely have it go through our headquarters people and through the attorneys at headquarters. We also always have it go through the attorneys in our region. Even though it's not a legal document, we want them to look at the language to make sure there can't be any confusion. And so we normally have an attorney sign off on the ready for reuse document within the region and all the time. And the first time with the headquarters and the attorneys in headquarters. And then if we have a site that might be in a gray area, we would want to run it through headquarters and make sure we've got everybody's blessing on it. Slide number 111. Okay, who prepares a ready-for-use determination? most of the ready for reuse determinations prepared have been done by our in-kind service consultant, Skeel Solutions. They draft them up. However, an RPM can put one together, or an OSC. Most of the time, the RPM or the OSC is the technical expert in the ready for reuse document. So we have them look through there to make sure that even though we're putting things in plain language, we've identified it correctly, that we've said things correctly as far as the technical aspects of the site. As far as like the roles of the states and the tribes and local governments, we always try to partner. We try to make a team approach. We call them in. We call the states in, let them know what's going on, have their input into it, tribes and local governments too. What happens though when we go through the sign-off process is we don't always have the states, the tribes, and the local governments sign off on the ready-for-use document. When I tried it in the state of Ohio, everybody was on board. They all took a look at it, but they just said that the administrative process of going through a sign-off on a document that they've never had before would be very resource-intensive. So even though they looked at the ready-for-reuse document, the state RPM and the state community involvement coordinator and the state attorney, they didn't sign off on it. They gave me review comments. I put them in there. But they were on board, concurred with it, but they just didn't sign off on their concurrence. The role of the landowner is basically, you know, he's the guy who's, he's got to say that he wants to have a ready-for-reuse determination made. He's going to receive that and probably benefit from the value added in it. For example, the Lawrence County Economic Development Agency, the gentleman that runs that facility has a large frame picture of the ready-for-reuse document up there. And when tenants come in to look about, you know, renting some buildings that he has on site for commercial or industrial use, he uses that to tell them the EPA has condoned the site, it's okay for an industrial use. As far as public notice requirements, I don't believe there are any public notice requirements to publish a ready-for-reuse determination document. Most of the public notice requirements have already been done through the Superfund process to get to that point. There might be a few incidents where we might have to put a, but what we would put is when the ready-for-reuse document's done, we put it in the information repository as part of some of the site files. Slide number 112, please. Okay. And one of the things, when we put together an RFR, we don't put new investigations. We look at all the existing documents. We talk to the responsible parties. We talk to the landowners. We talk to the local community that's around there. It's not something that we have to go out and do an investigation and put a new report together. It's a summarization of all the stuff that's been out there put into plain language so everybody can kind of understand it. Slide number 113, please. Okay, and here's the just a real quick case study. It has to do with the South Point plant. It's a large industrial facility that was a defense facility in, right after World War II. Contaminated a lot of the property. The Lawrence County Economic Development Agency bought the 610 acres and started, they had a couple of industrial clients at the very beginning, but they were having hard times getting tenants in because when a company would come to them and say, yeah, we want to set up shop on your property, they would, the tenant would find out it was a Superfund site. And that would be a very, you know, the stigma would be out there. Okay, would my workers, are they going to sue me later because they're exposed? Am I going to get problems when I try to go borrow from the bank? Well, what we did for the Lawrence County Economic Development Corporation is we put a ready-for-reuse determination document together that said the site was okay for an industrial/commercial use. We wrote in plain language in a report saying what had happened out there, what we had done, what's the current status of the site, what's restricted, what's not restricted, which areas are restricted, which areas aren't restricted, and it really helped them out. People would come in there, they would see that on his wall, that the EPA and the state of Ohio condone the reuse of the site, and he was able to get more clients there, and I think they've got maybe 11 there now. Slide 114. And this is, here we are right now, we're doing the ribbon cutting ceremony. This is a while ago. This is when President Bush got elected the second time when the Chads were falling in Florida, I remember. But you can see that the South Point, they got a real nice, you know, building going there, the Chapman Steel, we just had an opening event for, and the Ready for Reuse document has really helped them out at South Point Plant, HOD Landfill, and a couple other ones that we have here in Region 5. Slide number 115. So here's some take-home lessons. The RFRs can help protect the site's remedy through long-term stewardship, through getting the community's eyes and ears on the site. They take some ownership and some responsibility for the site. They also help to facilitate reuses when they remove stigma concerns out there. If they're not mandatory, we don't have to do them. They're done with existing documents that are out there, and they're relatively easy to write. And I think for the value added, they work out pretty good in the cases where we have some stigma concerns out at the site. Slide number 116, there's my contact information. Call me anytime. I like to talk.
Thank you, Tom.
Melissa, back to you.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, everybody. I'd like to ask the people on the phone if they have any questions. Just remember, you have to unmute your line if you want to ask a question. And I don't think there's an especially organized way to do that, but if you are on the phone and you want to ask a question, please unmute your line, and now is the time to ask.
Yeah, so if you use the keypad function to mute your line, you can unmute yourself by hitting #6. Or if you used your phone's mute. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Sai Apajim from Region 6 in Dallas.
Yes.
I have a question for Fran. I was just curious about the remedy at the site, Midvale site.
Yes, Sai, what's your question?
Oh, the remedy at OU 1 and 2 at the site?
Oh, specifically? What we basically did after getting rid of the structures on site and all the debris is actually we regraded the site using the slag and put clean covers over it. So the slag, which we had a lot of information on and which wasn't really bioavailable or leachable, is still there on the site. And then we have covers, and the record of decision allows a certain amount of soil, or you could put parking lots, buildings also to actually break the barrier with the contamination. So much of the waste is still there. I mean, it's the city has institutional controls about what to do if you're going to put water lines through or you're going to dig foundations and how you handle the material. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so you're saying that there's still contamination, but it's clean to rest to commercial or standard.
It's actually there's areas of the site that have residential as well, and mm-hmm. there's also a few areas of the site, because remember it was over 446 acres. There's some areas where a developer worked with us. They wanted to go even better, and they didn't want institutional control, so they cleaned up to a level that EPA and the state agreed was unlimited use and restricted exposure. So it's a mixture of cleanups out there, but where it's needed, there's institutional controls, and where it's not needed, we have that part of the property free and clear of ICs.
So the cleanup is not uniform then throughout the site, so you have pockets where you have different cleanup.
Yes, but it's also, I didn't go into all the details, but for the most part, operable unit one was buffer land. It never did have the smelter buildings or processes on it. So just because of that, the cleanups were slightly different between the different operable units. But a lot of the waste is still there, but it's there in a way that we all feel can be managed over time in a protective fashion. And so there's all those different uses are actually happening on the site right now, including in certain locations there's residential housing.
Great. Yeah, that looks very big change from the time it started to what's now.
We're pretty proud of it.
Thank you.
That's great. Great. Thanks, Cy, for your question. Does someone else on the phone have a question? Someone out there who wants to ask a question? Okay. All right. We're all available. You want to just go to the left?
Yeah. We can still take questions online if anyone thinks of one in the last couple minutes here. But I want to just take you through the last few slides in today's webinar. So if you go to slide 118, you'll see Melissa Friedland's contact information if you have any more questions for her. And then there's also Frank Avasado, who works with Melissa and is the project officer for the contract for this Superfund redevelopment initiative. And then on slide 119, sure.
Just be on the lookout for our next webinar.
Oh, yes, and we'll be having another Superfund redevelopment webinar. I believe we're planning it for March sometime, and we're going to have the topic of ecological revitalization of contaminated sites, so stay tuned for that. And then on slide 119, I just want to direct you to a link where you can click on for additional resources related to Superfund redevelopment, and then also our feedback form, and I would really appreciate it if you could take the time to fill out that form, let us know what you thought of today's webinar, and any ideas you have for future webinars. So just click on that form, and it'll only take you a minute or so to complete. And then on slide 120, I just want to let you know there's new ways to stay connected with CLUIN. So if you're interested in learning about, new information we put on our website and upcoming webinars, you can click on any of these links to stay connected that way. And I guess I'm going to leave and see if Melissa has any closing remarks.
I just want to thank our panel. I think you guys have given a very great explanation of the kinds of work that you've done, and you've taken us through from sites that, if just looking at them from the beginning, you would never be able to imagine what they were able to become. And it's because of the hard work that you did and the tools that are out there and the ability to sort of have a vision about what we can do in this program. So I really appreciate your telling the stories that you've told and sharing your experience. And I hope our audience has enjoyed it, and I hope to talk to you all very soon. Please don't hesitate if you have any questions. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, everyone, for your attention, and this officially concludes today's webinar.